Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Today we're going to step away from the insanity of this election season just for a moment to talk about trees. Trees play an extraordinarily important role in our cityscapes. They are living landmarks that define space, cool the air, soothe our psyches, connect us to nature, and even improve our health. This morning we talked with Jill Jones, author of Urban Forests, A Natural History of Trees and People in the American Cityscape, about how urban forests have come to define the cities and neighborhoods we live in. We'll talk about blights like Dutch elm disease that have wreaked havoc on urban trees and why it matters so much that we not only protect the urban trees we have, but also dedicate ourselves to increasing the urban tree canopy. Jill, welcome to Locus Focus.
Well, lovely to be talking to someone in Portland.
Yes, the land of trees here.
Yes.
Actually, I was rather surprised when I started reading your book, because I think of urban forests. I'm not sure how much time you've spent here in Portland, but we have like a rather large urban forest in the city limits called Forest Park, which is 2,000 acres of actual near wilderness kind of landscape. And so I think of urban forests as being like natural areas that have the full range from the understory through the tree canopy. But I was surprised as I started reading your book that you were largely talking about street trees and city parks that are basically grass and trees. So how can we call something that's a forest that doesn't have the full ecology of what we consider a forest ecology?
Well, it does. It is sort of an oxymoron, but that so the urban forest is collectively all the trees within a city's limits. So that most places are not as fortunate as Portland to have 2,000 acres of what sounds like close to a genuine forest. Most places have a certain number of city parks. And so the standard definition of an urban forest, which I have to say is a relatively new concept, as in, you know, starting really in the 60s, includes street trees, park trees, you know, what we are now coming to call forest patches, these sort of broken up bits and pieces of woods that survive. And then also what's in people's private property. And in a lot of cities, the bulk of the urban forest is on people's private properties.
Probably not so much in New York City, but certainly in a place like Portland or, well, Seattle used to have a lot more trees than it has now. But how can we consider this a forest? I mean, I'm wondering why they use the term forest, because I've heard this term too. I mean, it's used in Portland, and I've always kind of scratched my head when I started realizing that urban forest didn't refer to Forest Park, but referred as much to the trees in front of my house. How do we call this a forest when a forest has, like, historically a much different meaning?
Well, by putting the word urban in front of it.
And that changes
Simple
everything.
Simple as that. It's been rebranded.
Well, what I found real interesting in your description of one of the cities of trees that you described, Sacramento, California, that it started out having this notable treescape because they hadn't cut down all the native trees yet. And then, as they did in most cities, they cut down all the trees. And then the problem was, how do we regrow trees in an area that's been denuded? I mean, Portland, one of Portland's nicknames is Stumptown, because it was like a thick, dense, mixed tree forest that the settlers came and cut down all the trees and built at least downtown Portland. Portland still has, fortunately, a number of native trees that survive the onslaught of urbanization. But of course, like other cities, most of the trees have been planted as an afterthought. And I'm wondering what kind of lessons were lost, perhaps, by not retaining the native trees that were on the areas that got platted for streets and housing and businesses and stuff like that.
Well, I mean, the reality is, even if those trees had been retained, I mean, the chances are they would now be dead, because, I mean, you know, trees have a limited life. But, I mean, the city of Washington, D.C., which on the East Coast is known as the City of Trees, I mean, was planned that they would not take down the trees. And yet, you know, people did that because they wanted the trees for fuel. They felt the trees were in their way. So trees were really not valued in America at all in the early centuries. And people thought nothing. I mean, we clear-cut all but 3% of our original forests. So trees were very, very taken for granted. And really, the point of my book, I mean, when I explain to people why did I do this book, because, they, you know, it seems like sort of an unusual topic, the majority of us live in cities now, and we're very aware of the built landscape, But most of us experience the grown landscape, which is largely trees, very intuitively, and I wasn't any different. So as I began to think about climate change and what can we do when we're living in cities, there's a very limited number of things you can do to cool down cities, but a major thing you can do is to have a very strategically thought out and sort of maximum urban forest. And that really is what my book is aimed at. I mean, it's aimed to be extremely entertaining, to be very compelling, but at the end of it, you should sort of understand, well, we had an urban tree movement in the 19th century. We ended up with very beautiful tree canopies, but they were mainly the American elm. So when Dutch elm disease struck in the 30s, and it just worked its way relentlessly but slowly across the country, it arrived on the West Coast in the 60s and 70s, I mean, that just took out these really beautiful tree canopies that most American cities had. About the same time that American cities sort of began to be in trouble because people, you know, were going out to the suburbs and there was a lot of new development and cities were being remade for automobiles. So in the 60s and 70s, I mean, people looked around and thought, ah, there are no trees. And the cities feel sort of bleak and hot. And that was really the beginning of the second urban forestry movement. And as I also tell in my book, I mean, one of the things that's quite sort of wonderful about that is that that came along at the same time as a lot of the development of a lot of new science and the technology that makes that science extremely accessible. So I'll tell you something that I have been told about Portland, and maybe you can tell me this is not correct. So through all this science, you now can quantify the ecosystem benefits of anything from an individual tree to entire urban forests. And you can map your city and where all the trees are and, you know, what kinds of trees and how mature they are and how healthy and so forth. And cities have started doing this, and it's revealed things they just didn't know or really think about their own urban forests. And I was told in Portland what they discovered is while Portland is famous for its trees, they are largely on one side of the river. And the side of the river that has traditionally been sort of the industrial side and has, you know, working class neighborhoods, but all now is being kind of changed in this kind of post-industrial world we live in, it was discovered that one side of the river really doesn't have almost any trees at all compared to the other.
Actually, that's actually not true.
It
depends. I was trying to figure out which side of the river you're talking about, and I'm assuming that you're saying that the west side has the trees and the east side doesn't.
Well, not as black and white as that, but just that the canopy is lower, noticeably lower.
It really varies from neighborhood to neighborhood. And I'm actually going to be doing a show in a couple of weeks about social equity and
the environmental
trees.
Justice aspect of
right,
that.
Because
great.
There's a whole concern about what's happening in Portland. And Portland has had an amazing tree canopy for years and years and years. And it's being threatened now by all this infill because a lot of empty lots and smaller, older buildings are being torn down and putting up these mixed-use four-story apartment buildings with retail on the ground floor. And it's kind of a big there's a lot of upsetness about it around the city. One of the concerns is that it's taking out backyard trees. So there's one of the issues that's coming in is like mandating that trees are planted whenever these new developments go in. But it's being argued that because the other issue in Portland is we are having a very, very small supply of affordable housing. So these affordable housing projects that are being planned to being built, there's a question about whether they're going to take the extra expense, so to speak, to make sure that trees are planted there. And so we're going to do a show about why it's important that trees are planted in low-income communities as well as in higher-income communities. But that's another show.
Let me ask you this. Do you have a tree ordinance?
Yeah, we do.
There?
And I'm going to find out more about it when I do this show in a couple of weeks.
Okay.
Because I knew we had a tree ordinance, and I think it's been chipped away at, so to speak. And so there's an effort to create, to strengthen the tree ordinance so it's going to cover all kinds of housing and not just middle, upper-income housing.
Right.
But we've had a tree orange for a really long time. And there was a period in the late 80s, early 90s when these row houses started going in. And it was a real change from just building a house on a lot to like bulldozing the entire lot, taking out all the trees and then putting up these houses. There was an oak in my old neighborhood that was being threatened by this townhouse project. And people's surrounded the oak and sat in there and slept in there and saved the oak. And it really kind of was initiated.
Galvanized people.
Yeah, and yeah. Initiated the current tree ordinance that we have, as a matter of fact.
Ah, I see. Okay, well, that's great.
But it's getting back to the issue about the one side of the river having trees and the other not. It's spottier than that. And there's some neighborhoods in the east side that have a lot of trees. And we're planting trees now, but KBOO is in one of the light industrial neighborhoods that's changing. And it's doesn't have the number of trees that, like, the neighborhood I live in that's much further south and closer to the river. But I do wonder, what was the point you were trying to get to there?
Well, what I was saying is that the technology makes possible these maps. So the very first place that this technology got developed was in Chicago. And, I mean, essentially before, and all of this technology is now sort of encapsulated in a public domain website, free website called iTree. And there's many variations of iTree. And the science that went into it was looking, you know, was developed basically because foresters realized that if you went to City Hall and said, you know, you really need to start planting, you know, more trees, more street trees, you need to have, you know, a richer, better urban forest, the managers would say, well, you know, that's just an expense, so why would we do that? We have air conditioning, so we don't need trees to cool us down. We have public medicine, so sort of in the 19th century, those were a lot of the driving forces behind having, like, a really dense tree canopy was there wasn't air conditioning, and it was believed that cooling things down and then the trees themselves by, you know, purifying the air and absorbing standing water were, you know, helping to improve the overall public health. So these ecosystem benefits then could show a city manager, well, you know, one average tree, and we'll take an example of New York City, can absorb 1,400 gallons of stormwater in a year. Well, you multiply that by enough, and you're starting to look at some really significant savings. By the same token, so New York City, you know, I mean, many, many cities have had this done, but in New York City, it had a really profound effect when Mayor Bloomberg was running things. The Forest Service came in 2006, and essentially what they figured out from the street trees, there are 600,000 of them in New York City, is that, for instance, like one street tree would remove 1.73 pounds of air pollutants. The energy savings collectively for the street trees was $28 million, or about $47 a tree. So Bloomberg, you know, sort of absorbed all this data and, you know, realized that, oh, these trees are actually doing a lot of very practical things. And therefore, for every dollar we're spending on trees, street trees, we're actually getting $5 in benefits. And so he quadrupled the Forest Service, the forestry budget, and he also launched Million Trees NYC. So this data is really important for having a dialogue with people who run cities. And that has really, really revolutionized urban forestry. The other, however, leading edge of this is public health. So we all know that if people sort of intuitively have a choice and they have the money to live wherever they want, I mean, they live surrounded by trees. I mean, this mapping has really kind of revealed that trees are markers of affluence. So when they did this marking tree mapping in L.A., they found that, you know, the wealthy neighborhoods had tree canopies of like 40-45%. And poor neighborhoods had tree canopies of like 6% to 15%. So now people are starting to look at, well, so what does it mean for human beings to be amidst trees? And actually, Jeffrey Donovan is a U.S. Forest Service economist who's done a lot of really cutting-edge research, and he operates out of Portland. And his research in Portland showed that pregnant women living in, you know, specific locations in Portland that were closer to trees, more surrounded by trees, their birth outcomes were better. And this is research that's been replicated in a number of other countries. By the same token, when Jeffrey Donovan realized, oh, we've lost 100 million ash trees to the emerald ash borer in, you know, certain Midwestern states, he sort of flipped that on his head. It's like, okay, let's look at these counties where you've lost, you know, tens of millions of trees and see what happened to the mortality rates. And by, you know, on that end, you could see that the mortality rates had risen. And so Jeffrey Donovan has this line, which is that trees are a matter of life and death. So there is this emerging public health science, which I think would be far more relevant and sort of persuasive to the, you know, kind of bulk of average citizens, because most of us do not walk out of our door and look at a beautiful tree and think, ah, I'm so glad that tree is saving me $3 in stormwater costs. What you think is, you know, the tree is beautiful, the light comes through it in a wonderful way, it shades your house, you know, turns lovely colors in the fall, maybe it has flowers in the spring. I mean, you get a lot of aesthetic pleasure out of it. But that aesthetic pleasure is beyond aesthetic pleasure. I mean, it's actually contributing to your well-being as a human. And that's where things are really going with urban forests. And so if all of us are, you know, not all of us, but the bulk of us, the majority of us, are electing to live in cities, and we know that it's really important for people to have nature in their lives, we really need to be thinking in terms of retrofitting our cities with nature, what we also now call green infrastructure. Because, you know, when I began this book, it was sort of like, okay, well, you just cut more tree pits. I mean, now people realize it's not really about that. It's like you've got to have more than just tree pits. You basically need to, you know, be bringing in an entire pulling up of impervious pavement and redesigning the way cities are so that people are much more immersed in nature.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Jill Jones, who is the author of Urban Forests, A Natural History of Trees and People in the American Cityscape. Speaking of green infrastructure, after Hurricane Sandy struck New York and the Northeast, that was 4 years ago now, I heard some talk about there being some consideration of replacing some of New York City gray infrastructure, the sewer pipes and storm walls and things like that, with more green infrastructure and basically taking out some of the hardscape in lower Manhattan and in parts of Brooklyn and areas in Queens and areas that are, you know, close to the ocean or the harbor, and basically returning them to tidal marshlands. And that's an idea I don't think that flew too well. And I think that they're thinking now more of putting up seawalls and gates and stuff like that, like they have on the Thames in London. But I'm wondering if you follow that and if you've heard anything more about the possibility of New York becoming a little bit greener.
Oh, well, there's no question. I mean, if you go to New York, it's stunning. I mean, first of all, they did, in fact, plant their million trees, which I write about in my book. So, I mean, it's quite described there. But to understand sort of the scale of what happened, a typical city plants anywhere from sort of 6 to 15,000 street trees a year. New York City went to planting a total of 200,000. So they were planting 20,000 over a period, 25,000 a year. And then they were also planting these, you know, much smaller trees in the parks. And they did plant a million trees. And actually, one thing I should say, since you're there in Portland, is so Schmidt's Nursery, which is not so far away, like an hour outside of
actually,
Portland.
It's a half hour from my house in Boring, Oregon, yeah.
Yes, beautiful, beautiful, beautiful place. So I went. So when I was reporting about what was happening in New York, I went to the nursery in actually Maryland, where they were had contracted for a bunch of these trees. They had 200,000 baby trees on this land. And I said, oh, well, so how do you grow these? And they said, oh, well, we get them from Oregon. They come from Schmidt's. So in the end, one of the things they had to do in New York to make it possible to plant so many trees is they eliminated the middlemen and they contracted with three local, relatively local nurseries. And it turned out that of the million trees that were planted in New York, 750,000 of them started their lives at Schmidt's, which plants, which sells a million trees a year. So that was a great surprise to me.
Well, actually,
these trees on West 143rd Street, you know, started their lives outside of Portland.
Well, a lot of your Christmas trees also come from Oregon as well.
Yeah, I mean, Oregon. A lot of trees come from Oregon.
Oregon is actually Clackamas County, where Schmidt's Nursery is probably one of the nursery capitals of the United States, and it's lots and lots of nurseries, and particularly tree nurseries. And I'm very familiar. I mean, I go by Schmidt's all the time when I'm going up to Mount Hood. And it's a very notable place. And there's a lot of other nurseries, major nurseries, between Portland and Mount Hood that also do probably a lot of supplying. I found it kind of interesting, actually. When I moved to Portland, it was the Dutch elm disease epidemic. It pretty much wiped out all the trees in my hometown, which is another place you focus on in your book, which was Worcester, Massachusetts.
Oh, my goodness,
which was never...
They've had the worst tree karma ever,
We'll talk about that in a little bit, because I want to talk about Dutch elm and chestnut blight before we get to the insects that started boring. But when I came to Portland, there were just enormous groves of elm trees in downtown Portland in particular, in what we call our South Park blocks and our North Park blocks. And I started hearing stories within a couple years of moving here that there was concern about Dutch elm reaching the park blocks in downtown Portland. We still have a lot of elm trees here. I don't think the blight ever struck as badly here as it did, particularly in Worcester, where Elm Park, which was about a half a mile from where I grew up, by the time I was 12 years old, there were no more trees in Elm Park. They'd all been succumbed to Dutch elm disease.
Well, I'm going to guess that your elms get injected with something called imidacloprid, because there is a treatment, a pesticide. So Dutch elm disease is spread by bark beetles, and if you can... So you inject this imidacloprid, and it goes, you know, all the way through the tree, you know, sort of rising with the sap. And when if there are any beetles, it does them in. And that actually is how a lot of very large old elms have survived, especially, you know, if they're sort of prize city trees. The city, you know, a city will spend that kind of money to, you know, keep them alive.
Well, one of the things that struck me as I was reading first about the chestnut blight and then about Dutch elm disease, that one of the concerns that it seemed to show about urban tree canopies is that there's most urban forests, as you call them, are monocultures, which is again,
well, not anymore, but
they were.
Absolutely were then.
Right, yeah. When I was growing up, and that's why all the elm trees died in my town, and we had no more trees. Actually, on my block, it was all Norway maples, and it seems that the way that the trees are planted, and they still were planted until not that long ago, was that we just thought about like one kind of tree and we just put them everywhere. And we know that in nature that's very unsustainable. We know that in farming it's unsustainable. And it seems that the ways that trees were wiped out by various blights is an indication that monocropping for urban forests is no more sustainable than monocropping for agriculture.
Right, and actually, if you would talk to any urban forester today, you would find that they try and have a wide range of species for exactly this reason. So, and part of the issue becomes, well, who's doing the planting? So in the Midwest, where there was a lot of suburban developments and just developments in general built about the same time that the elm trees were disappearing, the developers, because it was the easy thing to do and because there were no rules about this, they did plant basically monocultures of ash trees. And, you know, now very few people realize this, and I have to include myself among those people before I got involved in this book, that we are actually in the midst of the worst tree eco disaster in the history of our country, because when we lost all the American chestnuts, there were only American chestnuts largely in the southeast.
Actually, let's back up a little bit, because people, probably a lot of listeners don't even know, they probably don't even know what American chestnut is anymore.
Right.
So let's just talk about the role that chestnut trees played in the United States before they were wiped out.
Right, okay. So American chestnuts were kind of a very dominant and very ecologically important tree in the southeast. And most people associate them with the Appalachians, where they were really dominant in the forest, and they played a big role in the economy because they were excellent wood, and they grew chestnuts, and those were harvested and extremely popular. But there were also chestnut trees through all the cities, northeastern cities, in parks and people's yards and so forth. They were very large trees, but they had been there often for 100, 200 years. And in 1904, the Bronx Zoo noticed, which was filled with huge mature chestnuts, noticed that they were beginning to die. And someone from the New York Botanical Garden, which is very close by, figured out that this was a blight that probably had come from China on nursery stock some years earlier, but finally it sort of gathered the potency to just begin racing through very old trees and killing them within 2 or 3 years. And that was 1904, and at the time, the mycologist, which is a mushroom expert who figured this out, just said, this is hopeless, you can't do anything about it because it's a wind-borne blight and it's really lethal. So there was, in fact, a lot of time and energy and money spent trying to save American chestnuts by, you know, sort of cutting these quarantine rings, but it did not work, and eventually it worked its way down into the Appalachians. And there's the American Chestnut Foundation has been working for many years to try and develop, and they feel they are close, but they're, you know, not there yet, as far as anyone knows, to having, you know, a chestnut tree that has been sort of crossed enough times with Chinese chestnuts to have a small enough part of the Chinese chestnut in its genome that it can fight off the blight, but otherwise, you know, look like an American chestnut. So that was the first big, really, you know, global consequence tree-killing blight in the United States, at least that anyone knows. And that was essentially went on from kind of 1900 to the 1930s. And then about the time that that kind of petered out, well, then arrived the Dutch elm disease, which, despite the name, is in fact another, in this case, Asian fungus and beetles that carry it. And that came over not on live nursery stock, but on lumber meant for furniture from Europe, where the Dutch elm disease was just busy wiping out all the elms. So that started in the 1930s, and I mean, there still is Dutch elm disease around today, but it's not, you know, it's sort of episodic. There are not as many elms. And the happy ending to that story is after many, many decades, the USDA did find and develop and bring back into the nursery trade American elms that are able to tolerate Dutch elm disease. So the irony of the ash and the emerald ash borer showed up in 2002 is that as we're losing ash trees, and the reason the ash loss is so huge is that the emerald ash borer, in this case, it's not a fungus or a blight. It is a tiny little insect, but they just gnaw their way through trees in such a way that they can kill the trees in a matter of years. I mean, like 2 or 3, 4 or 5 years. And in the case of the American elm, it's a native species, and it exists from coast to coast. And it's both been a very successful, sort of sturdy, will tolerate anything city tree, but it's also very common in the woodlands. And it's in so the emerald ash borer has been detected in 28 states. It has not crossed the Rockies, but it is expected to. And so the assumption is that we will lose pretty much all of the native American ash trees. And if you live in a state where this is going on, I mean, you really can see it happening before your eyes. You know, the trees start to get kind of naked, and then they look very skeletal, and then that's it. They, you know, no more leaves. They're done. I just want to say that there has been proposed by a bunch of forest scientists and policymakers legislation to try and, you know, break this cycle, and it's called Tree Smart Trade. So in the case of Dutch elm disease and also the emerald ash borer, these insects arrived in wood. In the case of the emerald ash borer, it came in wooden pallets. And with the amount of trade we do all over the world, but especially with China, which is where these things mainly seem to come from, you know, we really cannot afford to have any kind of wooden anything coming from overseas anymore. Nor can we afford to let any more live nursery stock in. So this legislation would bring an end to that. And it's called Tree Smart Trade. Has its own website. Apparently, there's work going on, you know, on the Capitol Hill to try and, you know, get this move forward. And I think you'd be hard pressed to argue that people should continue on as they have, because otherwise, you're just not going to have any trees left in this country that can withstand the sorts of pests and plagues that get brought in with global trade. And IKEA, major global trade company, already has gotten rid of pallets and everything is done with paper. So it's a perfectly feasible thing to do.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Jill Jones, who's author of Urban Forests, The Natural History of Trees and People in the American Cityscape. For the last few minutes of the show, I want to go back to Worcester, Massachusetts, which you say is the city with the worst tree karma. This is where I grew up, and it was not a place that was really noted for its trees. I mean, I just mentioned we had a Norway maple canopy, which if we had more time, we could talk about the downside of Norway maples, because I know, talking to horticulturists here in Portland, they are aghast at Norway maples as a tree, an invasive species you don't want to plant. But why don't you describe what happened in Worcester and what was so frightening about it?
Well, so first of all, Worcester had an elm canopy like everyone else. So they lost, you know, a lot of their elm canopy. Then there was, even before that, the 1938 hurricane came roaring through. I mean, I don't think it's ever been anything comparable, and took out tons of trees. And it, so that wasn't just Worcester, it was many places. But on top of that, there was a subsequent 1958 kind of tornado hurricane.
It was actually ripped up. It was 53. I remember it well.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So also ripped up tons of trees, and when they replanted all those trees, a lot of them were Norway maples, because that was a very tough tree, and at that time they didn't realize it was invasive. So, you know, lo and behold, in I'm trying to think what the date was. It's like 2006, 2008. They discovered that Worcester becomes one of really just a handful of places where they find the Asian longhorn beetle. What is its favorite food? Maples. And at that time, they did not have any way to treat trees to fend off these bugs. And so they just began all this clear cutting. So poor Worcester, which was already, because it was sort of was an industrial city on hard times, they were not replacing their trees. Where they'd once had 50,000 street trees, they were down to 17,000. So, I mean, they'd lost like two-thirds of their canopy almost, and then they just started clear-cutting. And I'd say the only upside of this, and I've actually been, as you can imagine, I mean, numerous times to Worcester in the course of reporting this book. The only upside is it has mobilized and galvanized a very concerted effort to restore the tree canopy, which actually, before they were losing all these trees to the Asian longhorn beetle, you know, that wasn't even under discussion, really. The other thing that's really scary about Worcester and the Asian longhorn beetle is that the the U.S. government has poured in resources there, because you're really talking about being on the edge of the great, you know, northeastern hardwood forest, which, as we know, is heavily maple. And there's just this horrible fear that if the Asian longhorn beetle gets in there, I mean, that's not a situation where, you know, you're going to go in and inject trees to save them. I mean, so New York City also has the Asian longhorn beetle. They've been battling it for 20 years, and they discovered in Chicago when they were, you know, also battling it in the early 2000s that you could inject trees with imidacloprid. And so they began, in New York City, they inject 200,000 street trees with imidacloprid to prevent those trees from having to be taken down as, you know, part of battling the Asian longhorn beetle.
I just wanted to interject for a second. My question, actually, when I was reading your book, is what effect does injecting the trees with this chemical have on wildlife that thrives in trees, like birds and insects that the birds eat?
Well, it's only things that actually eat the leaves and in sort of the crotches of the twigs, because Asian longhorn beetles like to eat that very specifically. I mean, that is a really good question. And as far as people have been able to figure out, it's, you know, it seems okay. I mean, but we all know that. So that's potentially a big environmental trade-off if it turned out that that was an issue, because it would mean, like, okay, you're going to take down 200,000 mature street trees over a question of, you know, what's happening to certain bugs in addition to the Asian longhorn beetle. And that is a good question, and I honestly don't know whether there is a deep and or meaningful answer to that.
Because one of the concerns, I mean, taking down all these trees is certainly destroying habitat for lots and lots of birds.
Right.
But if you're going to kill, but if you're going to kill the insects that they eat or poison the insects that they eat, that could also,
in addition to Asian longhorn beetle,
right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So anyway, back to Worcester. So they did finally actually discover the source point for this the infestation that was Maybe I'm thinking about there was at Norton's Industries, there was an infestation.
Right, the pallets. I mean, they just had huge, huge piles of wooden pallets. And that was ground zero.
So once they got rid of those pallets, did that help to curb the infestation?
Well, no, because by that time it's, you know, the beetles are out of the bag. I mean, the pallets are just the way that the beetles travel from China to the U.S., and, you know, then once they're wherever they land up. And, I mean, the amazing thing about the Asian longhorn beetle is actually how few places it has shown up. I mean, now under the supposed regulations, all pallets are supposed to be baked to such a heat that nothing could survive in them. But, you know, you have to ask, I mean, how much do people really follow those rules, and what might survive that, and therefore, you know, are you going to find out that, oh, by the way, emerald ash borer didn't get affected by that. They have a different tolerance, which is why they're proposing to ban the importation of anything using wooden pallets. Anything that can be in wood or carried by wood that comes from another shore really should not come onto our shores.
Well, I think that's like a real common wisdom. I mean, if you talk to any ecologist, and they probably would have been saying that for the last 100 years, that when you understand how an invasive species comes to a place where it doesn't have any natural predators and it just takes off. And this seems like that's an indication of that. And so since we're so careful and certain, well, with all the debris that came from Japan after the earthquake and the tsunami in 2011, there was this huge dock that arrived on the Oregon coast, and people were really concerned about all the possibly invasive species that were on that dock, and they did the best they could to basically neutralize it before the whole thing was disposed of. But so on that level, we're so aware of why we don't want to allow invasive species in, but it seems like this is another example of where we should just be really putting that foot down.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. I mean, so part of the reasoning between this behind this tree smart trade is, okay, so you have shippers and merchants, and they are dependent on this system of pallets and bringing in live nursery stock. But when that brings in some incredibly destructive pest, which, like the emerald ash borer, is now going to basically extirpate an entire series of ash species, and which are really important in, you know, entire woodlands and entire cities, it's not the shippers and merchants that pay the cost for that. It is we, the taxpayers. I mean, we have spent, I mean, I wouldn't be at all surprised if it's close to $1 billion just trying to address these issues that have been created by the importation of these tree-killing entities, whether, you know, it's fungus or it's bugs, and then the cost of replacing the trees. So, you know, we, the taxpayers, are basically paying the cost of other people, you know, making a living. So the way they make their living has to change to accommodate the fact that we shouldn't have to pay for the sort of collateral damage that that causes.
Well, Jill, I want to thank you very much for joining us. We're out of town now, but I want to thank you, and it's been very interesting learning about all the horrible scourges on our trees and hopefully a turnaround in appreciating the need for trees in our cities.
But one thing I do want to make clear to anyone who's interested in my book is that, you know, there's a lot of wonderful things in the book about the wonderfulness of trees, about historic trees, about, you know, the arrival of these new kinds of trees that we didn't have before, that, you know, I mean, there's the plant explorers, there's a lot of sort of wonderful people and delightful history woven through all this, but, you know, we're kind of talking about just hard issues,
right?
And I do write about all those things also, but believe me, I've tried to do it in a way that is entertaining, that is compelling, and at the end of it, you will come out at the other side and look around you at all the trees and think, oh, that's how they got there, and oh, that's what this tree is doing. So I just, you know, want to convey that, because that was really kind of my goal with the book, was to write something that's a really good read. This is my sixth
book, I specialize
in that.
Okay, we really have to go. But anyway, thanks a whole lot for joining us, Jill.
Okay, thanks so much. Bye-bye.
We've been talking with Jill Jones, who's author of Urban Forest, The Natural History of Trees and People in the American Landscape. And you've been listening to Locust Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locustfocus. I want to remind you to get out and vote if you haven't done that already. This is, people are saying, is the most important election of our lifetime and maybe lifetimes in the future. So make sure you get out and vote in the next week. Next week, we'll be talking with Harry McCormick, who's an organic farmer and founder of Oregon Tilth, about the need to protect not just farmland, but foodland in Oregon. And I'm also hoping to get people from the Rural Organizing Project on soon to talk about the acquittal of Bundy brothers and their cohorts in the takeover of Malheur last winter. My engineer is Derek Crooks. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Thanks for listening.
There is a tree.